Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. A glimmer of hope behind the ash cloud for travelers in Europe, the United States, and around the world. Some flights are taking off, but for millions of stranded travelers, it's day six and counting. Airlines have lost billions. Fruits and flowers are wilting in Kenyan warehouses, all at the mercy of one volcano in Iceland. This hour on Point, Iceland's eruption and the global disruption. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the brilliant images out of Iceland? Are you awed or stranded by the power of Mother Nature? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me from London now is Robert Wright, transport correspondent for the Financial Times. Robert, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And from Washington, we're joined by Alan Levin, aviation and transportation correspondent for USA Today. Alan, it's great to have you as well. Thank you.
Hi, thanks.
Robert, I'll begin with you in London. The most direct casualty of the volcanic ash is, of course, the airline industry. What's the latest on travel in Europe right now?
Well, there does seem to be some opening up of some airspace. There does seem to be a thinning of the cloud at various points, and so we are seeing some flights today in Europe. We're seeing more flights now than any time since last Thursday when the system began to shut down. But I think even if the situation clears now, we're going to see intermittent disruption probably for a while because the volcano is going to keep erupting, and every now and again we're going to get another big cloud of ash coming down over the UK. And I think the other thing is obviously any system like this, any complex system, you don't just restart it immediately. There are planes in the wrong place, everything's messed up, and so it's going to take quite some time. Somebody was saying to me today, even if everything starts again, which I'm not entirely sure it is going to, it's probably going to be another 2 to 3 weeks before things are operating normally. So it's a very, very severe disruption.
So what percentage of flights are actually getting off the ground? Is it half, more than half?
I don't have a figure quite to hand. I think it's roughly about half at the moment. It's not anything like the normal number that you would expect. In fact, today as I was cycling to work in London, I looked up, saw a vapor trail in the sky and was quite excited, which is obviously something unusual. You expect to see the sky full of them, and to see that it's been empty of them for so long is quite something.
In fact, zones have been created. Is that right, Robert, to regulate and monitor and direct air travel going forward?
That's not my direct expertise because I tend to cover other forms of transport, but I think they are working on all kinds of innovative solutions about how you move forward from here. And indeed, people are revisiting things like how much ash an aircraft engine can take. It was assumed that you had to take a zero tolerance policy. People are beginning to re-examine all kinds of things that they thought they knew in light of the fact that you suddenly have some of the world's most important bits of airspace covered in this volcanic ash, and nobody expected that to happen.
I'm reading at the Associated Press here, a no-fly zone immediately over the ash cloud, a caution zone with some contamination where planes can fly, subject to engine checks for damage, and then an open skies zone. Alan Levin, let me turn to you. How has the no-fly zone in Europe affected travelers here in the United States?
Well, obviously, it hasn't been nearly as severe, but, there's an encampment of several hundred people at New York's JFK Airport, which is the big gateway to Europe. People who are stranded and have been there for days, bathing in the restrooms and that sort of thing. Schools have had to cancel trips. In terms of its impact on the U.S. Carriers, there are five airlines that fly to Europe, and they've had to cancel 80% of their flights to and from Europe since Thursday. That's not counting today. They're optimistic that they'll get at least some of the flights into the air. And those flights generate about $55 million a day. Now, all that revenue is not completely lost. Those passengers will rebook and fly at some future dates, but clearly, this is going to have an economic impact on already fragile industry here in the U.S.
Here's some sound from a German traveler who has been stranded in New York City for days, saying yesterday that she and other travelers have become resigned to these massive delays.
At first, everybody was crying, and I want to go home. Now it's kind of relaxed. Everybody's waiting. You can't do anything anyway.
Robert, right in London, I'm reading 95,000 flights canceled last week alone. How do you get through that kind of backlog? How do the airlines do it?
Well, I don't think they have any idea at the moment. But, I mean, at the moment what we're seeing in Europe is vast numbers of people trying to resort to alternative means of transport that really don't have the capacity to cope with it. I was at St Pancras Station in London yesterday, which is the only international station. There are huge queues waiting to get on the trains. There are huge numbers of people coming off the trains. They're laying on all the extra trains they can. So we're seeing huge, huge, huge demand for any other means of getting about, and suddenly people are discovering the somewhat dubious pleasures of travelling overland for long distances in Europe and having to work out alternative travel arrangements.
Are the airlines covering plane tickets, hotels? I mean, what are the additional costs, the extra costs associated with this, Robert?
Well, I mean, there's considerable controversy about this because the airlines are technically under European rules on the hook for a huge amount of the money that people are being forced to shell out. Obviously, if people are paying several thousand pounds, you know, the equivalent of, say, $3,000 or something like that for their travel and their accommodation, and they've sold a ticket for £70 or about $100, then, you know, the airlines have got some very serious concerns about meeting that kind of level of demand for money, and a lot of them simply aren't going to be able to do it. They're not financially strong enough, so there's now a huge controversy about how everybody gets passes, how everybody deals with the cost, who should be meeting the cost, whether there should be government support. So it is an enormous problem for the airlines.
Here's British. Oh, Alan, go ahead before I continue.
Oh, I was just going to say it's worth comparing to 9/11, which had a devastating effect, at least on the U.S. carriers. In September of 2001, the U.S. carriers canceled 100,000 flights, and that didn't count the international flights. But we're basically talking about the same sort of impact. Now, of course, there was a huge loss of life, and in many ways that's not comparable at all to what we're seeing now. But I think in terms of the economic impact on the carriers, it's a potentially devastating event.
Alan, are the airlines insured for this type of event? I mean, most airlines consider this an act of God, as I'm reading, that falls outside their insurance policies. So how do they absorb these losses?
You know, I asked that question yesterday, and I wasn't getting very clear answers. I think to some extent the airlines are still trying to sort that out. But the fact of the matter is I think that they are exposed tremendously, and they're probably not insured for a lot of this. And so they may be seeking bailouts and other forms of compensation from government.
Here's British Prime Minister Gordon Brown speaking yesterday with reporters about the impact of the volcanic eruption in Iceland on global air travel.
It's clear that we're in a dangerous world when a volcano in Iceland can cause such dramatic effects and cause what is probably the biggest disruption that we've seen to the transport industry, certainly the airline industry in Europe.
Alan, you mentioned it. Robert Wright, what about financial assistance for some of these airlines? They've been asking for it, and British Prime Minister Brown appears to suggest that he might give it.
Well, I think inevitably, given that it was an official decision to shut down the airspace, it's very unlikely that anybody's going to expect the airlines to shoulder all the burden of this cost. It remains to be seen exactly what the mechanism will be, as your other guest was saying, because you know, it's not clear exactly what the straightforward way of doing it is. In Europe, we have an awful lot of rules about competition, about state aid, that kind of thing. That will all have to be worked through. But I mean, this is an industry that's already facing quite severe problems as a result of the economic downturn, as a result of high fuel prices, things like that. So there clearly a lot of airlines were already in quite a difficult position, and this is potentially going to push some of them over the edge, I think.
Alan Levin, the economic ripple effect continues to spread, as you already mentioned. What are some of the other economic costs associated with this incident?
Well, it really runs the gamut, and I think it's a very dramatic illustration of how dependent our society and economy has become on air travel. You know, it's sort of happened very gradually, and we haven't noticed, but Everything from bringing flowers to market, fresh vegetables. Look at FedEx, UPS, and the equivalent European cargo haulers. They do billions a year in economic, just moving goods, computers to people's homes, and that sort of thing. So it's in many ways incalculable how dramatic this impact is.
Robert, will you speak to that from the other side of the pond, so to speak? I'm reading the travel disruptions threaten to slow the fledgling recovery of Europe's recession already battering economies throughout.
Yeah, I mean, what's important to know about the stuff that moves by air, the goods that move by air, is there's actually very little moves by air in volume terms. In the UK, it's less than 1% of the UK's trade goes by air. But it's 25% of the UK's trade by value. So it's very small, light things that are very, very valuable. And what you're beginning to see now in Europe is everybody's focusing on things like food because that's the kind of thing people understand. Actually, in both Europe and North America, to a large extent, food still tends to go by sea. If you go to most ports, you see big warehouses for things like bananas and apples and stuff like that. So while there are, as Alan said, things like flowers, some fresh beans, those kinds of things do go by air. They tend to be up at the very top end of things. It's those things, and those things are now shutting down some factories that really need those small, high-value things.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the impact of Iceland's volcano as it disrupts air traffic over Europe for the sixth straight day. Robert Wright is with us this hour from London. He's transport correspondent for the Financial Times. Alan Levin is also with us from Washington. He's aviation and transportation correspondent for USA Today. Let's go to the phones here before we move on. Bob is calling from Montreal, Canada. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the program.
Yes, hello, Jane. Thanks for a fascinating topic. I've been flying most of my life for about 40 years, and I've seen a gradual decline in the airline industry. 2001 sort of transformed airports into maximum security prisons. Now we see, passengers captive on the ground at airports. And the airlines have created much too large planes. The airports have overextended themselves. I think it's time to downscale the industry. My point is this. I think we're coming to the end of the jet age.
Mm. Bob, thank you. Alan Levin, do you agree? Is this going to change how we travel in a 21st century world?
Well, the caller raises a very interesting question. I mean, clearly, we're not going to get rid of our airplanes, and they're becoming ever more important to the economy and to moving people. But the industry really is at a turning point. It's lost a lot of its highest value customers to private aircraft, and competition has just shattered the economic models. Overall, it hasn't made money in probably a decade or more, and we have seen significant cuts in the U.S. of about 10 or 15% over the past couple of years or so as airlines have tried to trim down and maintain profitability. But it's a giant question mark how they're going to respond going forward here, I think.
Here's another call from Brookline, Massachusetts. Patricia is on the line. Hi, Patricia. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm calling to ask if someone will address the idea that if there is a disaster, the citizens pay for it, and when the airlines get a profit, the citizens don't get any of it. It doesn't make any sense to me. In many areas of our life these days, we ordinary citizens don't get in on the profit, but we sure have to take the debt.
Patricia, thanks. Alan, you want to respond to that, at least here in the United States? Airline bailouts and certainly passing along these costs to customers.
Well, as we've seen with this huge controversy in Washington over what to do about bailing out financial institutions, there's a lot of sensitivity over this. And more than one person with whom I've spoken this week has raised that very concern, and I suppose it'll add a lot of sensitivity on the part of governments as they try to come up with ways to keep this industry afloat, but without, you know, giving up too much money.
If I could come in on this a minute.
Yes, Robert.
There is a real issue, obviously, where you have this process where profits get privatized and losses get socialized, as has been said about the banking bailout. It is a real question. As I've said before, my key expertise is not in the airline industry, but I think it's fair to say that shareholders and other people with economic exposure to the airline industry have taken quite a few hits over the last few years. It's not been a particularly attractive area to invest, and shareholders have lost large sums of money over the last few years. So one shouldn't particularly think that they've had an easy time of it. I think they've shouldered a fair amount of suffering. The trouble is, a bit like the banking system, it gets to the point, well, you could now say, well, okay, it's your problem, you can go bust. The trouble is, we probably need an airline industry much the same way as we need a banking system. So if you let the current airline industry go bust, it's an open question about what airline industry replaces it and how you pay for it. So that I think is the key question here. This would have effects that would go far beyond those individual companies and those individual shareholders.
And it's in every government's interest to have a robust airline industry. For example, an awful lot of the troops we send over to the two wars we're engaged in now go on charter flights run by the airlines. So if those airlines go away, we're in a deep trouble.
Mm-hmm. Robert, final note. I know you have to run to get to your real job.
Yeah.
Is the world too dependent on air travel? Is that the bottom line?
Well, I was going to say that this whole debate, of course, looks a little bit different from a European perspective. In Europe, an awful lot of people talk about competition between high-speed rail and air, and there are an awful lot. Alan was saying that air is playing an increasingly important part in the U.S. economy. In some ways, air is not playing an increasingly important part in the European economy because there are a lot of high-speed rail lines. But on the other hand, we saw just before Christmas in the U.K., a series of problems with the Eurostar trains that link London to Paris and Brussels. They all broke down. People had to go back on the airlines, mm-hmm. and that caused very similar chaos to the kind we're currently seeing on a more restricted level. So there really isn't any transport system that is completely immune from any kind of disruption. I mean, I think this time a week ago, if I'd been told that we'd all be sitting around talking about an Icelandic volcano, I wouldn't have taken that. I wouldn't have taken that prospect particularly seriously.
I don't think any of us would have. Robert, thank you very much for your time.
Okay.
I really appreciate it, and I know you have a busy day ahead. Transport correspondent for the Financial Times, Robert Wright, joining us from London. Alan Levin, hold with us from Washington for a moment. I'd like to talk a bit about the science of all this. So joining me now also from Washington is Richard Wunderman, a volcanologist with the Smithsonian Institution's Global Volcanism Program. He's managing editor of the Bulletin of the Global Volcanism Network, and he sits on a working group for volcanic ash and aviation safety. Rick Wunderman, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Jane.
Is there any way to measure how long this volcano in Iceland will continue to erupt? It's calmed down a little bit, but there seems to be fits and starts here.
We don't know how to do that. It's actually just as hard as trying to guess which one will erupt next. Really hard problem.
I've been reading.
Someday we might.
I've been reading how this eruption is really a perfect storm, a combination of wind and ice conditions that turn an ordinary eruption into a crisis, a huge chaos. Can you help us understand that?
Well, I don't know. The eruptions in Iceland, when they're of decent size, frequently linger over Central and Northern Europe. So in that sense, it was kind of predictable. If there was a decent size eruption, there would be havoc. One of the issues, though, is that you have plumes visible in satellite data and clearly seen over wide areas. And it's hard to know how to decay, though, and you know that there's winds that's going to carry these in certain directions at known altitudes. So how do you know if it's going to rain, for example, which might bring down the ash and make it clear and fine 4 hours later. It's a very complicated problem.
As far as forecasting, I mean, what goes into it? It happens. Is there a pattern to these eruptions?
The eruptions themselves, very hard to really predict hour to hour and minute to minute. And
what about year to year, century to century?
Yeah, well, we do that. That's sort of the business we're in at the Global Volcanism Program. We have a lot of data on sort of the pace of the planet. Mind you that we don't see most of the volcanoes underwater. But, so the ones that are under air, you know, we call them the subaerial volcanoes, those volcanoes we have a reasonable handle on, but it's sort of a blink of an eye in geologic time. We only really have records for sort of hundreds of years. But using that, a typical eruption, about 10% are over within a day. About 10% go longer than 1,000 days. So the average, the mean length of an eruption is about 7 weeks. But, you know, this is kind of like averaging really different things and, you know, coming up with a mean number. It isn't often so meaningful. Often Icelandic eruptions, for example, this volcano at hand has erupted for on the order of sporadically for about a year for the few records we have. So, and in as short as a few weeks. So, you know, it's really hard to say.
What about Calta, Richard Wunderman? This is the volcano that's right next to the one that is erupting right now. Is there worry about that one, too?
Yes, that one that's next door, Katla, is frequently erupting in symphony with the one at hand. And, you know, that's kind of the norm. There are plenty of cases, though, where only Katla erupted. It's sort of the bigger brother of the one at hand, and it tends to be more explosive and have longer-lived eruptive cycles, have more impact, more explosive, you know, all the bad stuff. But the latest news I saw was it's still calm, no signs of it coming to life. So, you know, we have a very variable natural system. It's really complicated. Don't forget the stuff that's erupting has basically come up 6 miles, 9-10 kilometers from the upper mantle to the surface, and it probably has areas where it sort of gets collected in pods and large volumes. And some of the eruptions we've known actually have not actually been eruptions. They've only been storage of stuff at depth where the ground deformed and there was earthquakes, but it never came out. Mm. So, you know, it's a very complicated system. We don't really have all the tools to really understand and predict what's going to happen. We're lucky in many cases when we have instruments there ahead of time, like they had in Iceland, and really good teams of people watching it, and they can say within weeks or hours or months in some cases that there's going to be an eruption. Very hard, though, to say after that what's going to happen.
Here's an interview with the BBC yesterday of Iceland's president, Ólafur Grímsson. He said that the latest eruption was just a small rehearsal, quote-unquote, of what may come from his country's volcanoes.
Unfortunately, what we have seen in the last few days could only be a beginning of an experience which might be repeated throughout the 21st century, because the history of these volcanoes in my country shows that they will erupt regularly, and the time for example, for Katla to erupt is coming close.
The time is coming close. I'm curious what you think about the projected impact on the environment from this eruption that we've seen. What's the impact on weather, on climate, on health, Richard Wunderman?
Well, you know, the pace we're going at now, these eruptions are pretty moderate, and they probably are not injecting a lot of ash into the stratosphere. They almost have to get sort of half again higher, bigger and stronger. But if the wind were to carry this ash around Iceland, which amazingly so far it hasn't done much, mostly blown out to sea and toward the now the U.S., North America a little bit, and mostly toward the Europe. But if it were to blow over Iceland, there would be so much more dense fallout there than there has been, that there would be impacts. So, for example, we collect on people's roofs. You'd have to worry about the mass of stuff on your roof. There's a lot of particulate issues of whether you get it in your lungs. And the big one is fluorine gas, and which falls in rain. And fluorine is a halogen, a very potent chemical species, and it can cause poisoning in high concentrations. But this has killed a lot of people and a lot of sheep in the past cases of Icelandic eruptions, and caused as much as 20% of the population to die before people understood the problem.
Let me interrupt you to go back to our callers here. Susan is on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm concerned about safety. I've been following the maps on the BBC.com of the cloud, and I'm concerned that the disruption has just felt like it's gone on too long, and that that planes are just being put back up in the air without any new information about what can be tolerated. There's now these three levels of three zones, and I'm wondering what a caution zone means. I mean, can a plane remedy a situation when it's in a caution zone? And what if a plane fails in this environment? Is it now the general cost of all of this worth that? I'm curious about the safety.
Susan, thank you. Alan Levin, would you respond?
I think it's a very legitimate question, and you know, there's been a tremendous pressure in Europe to get these flights back up and running. But I know some of the safety professionals I talk to privately are a little concerned that maybe this decision to put planes in the air is being done without hard data. Now, there have been three really scary incidents involving volcanoes and aircraft in which planes lost all or most of their engines. Those occurred in, I think it's fair to say, thicker clouds than what we're seeing over Europe. So I do believe that the chances of a cataclysmic failure are pretty small. But on the other hand, it doesn't take very much of this dust to damage engines. There's a very telling case involving a NASA plane in 2000. They inadvertently flew through a cloud. They didn't even know it. There was no indication whatsoever. The only reason they knew it is the plane was, hooked up to a lot of sensing devices, and so they could tell they were in something. And they went back and tore down the engines. And even though the engines showed no sign of damage at the time, they found the volcanic ash had liquefied in the heat of the jet turbines and coated the parts of the inside of the engine. And one of the things they coated is these small cooling vents that keep the fan blades and whatnot cool inside the engine. And basically, it cost millions of dollars to repair these engines, and according to the report on this incident, you know, these engines were likely to fail within 100 or so hours, when normally they last for thousands of hours with high reliability. So, you know, there clearly is a very significant safety issue here, and that is why, and up to now, all we know is don't fly into these clouds. So I think this is going to prompt a lot more research into just how much ash is acceptable to fly through and what it does to engines and whatnot.
Richard Wunderman, I have 30 seconds before our break here. What exactly is in this ash from a scientific perspective, from a scientist? Is it rocks, shards of glass? What is it?
Well, a lot of the ash that travels a long way has to have a lot of surface area to weight in it. So it's often bubble walls of the pumice. And so, yeah, we call it shards of glass, this little angular particles that are able to float long way, and of course they melt quickly if they get in an engine, and in fact what I was going to say, you know, more than that, there's a lot of gases, including sulfurous gases and the fluorine I mentioned, and the chemistry of these is pretty well known, pretty well studied, and the effects on aircraft are very well known. It's been known for about 30 years what happens and how and why, but what's poorly known is the low threshold, and this is the whole problem here, is where is it there's still a little tiny bit of ash, perhaps, but it's basically safe to fly for many hours and not have problems. And that's where we need help,
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the volcano in Iceland and its global impact on travel, the economy, and airline safety. Later this hour, as we're talking about Mother Nature's cloud, we'll hear one scientist warning about the impact of man-made clouds. That's in a few minutes. I'm joined this hour by two great guests in Washington. Richard Wunderman is with us. He's a volcanologist with the Smithsonian Institution. And Alan Levin is also with us. He's transportation correspondent for USA Today. Back to the phones, Jennifer is on the line from Greenfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. The last caller kind of touched on my question. It does have to do with the tolerance of the a plane engine and how much previous data we really have been able to gather concerning, you know, what who makes the decisions, first of all, as to, you know, when they're going to put a plane in the air after a disaster like this, and how do they calculate data concerning what the tolerance is of an engine as far as ash and all of that?
Jennifer, thanks. Alan Levin?
It's an interesting question. You know, when there are all sorts of rules governing how an engine must tolerate things like birds and hail and rain and all, but there are no such standards for volcanic ash. And the thought is that we will avoid it completely and therefore avoid any safety issues. So and to some extent, we're headed into uncharted territory. You know, as Richard said, this problem is well understood for about 30 years or so, but there has not been any study about the level of ash that is acceptable, if any is acceptable. You know, it's possible that you may be able to fly safely through low or moderate clouds, one flight, two flight, ten flights, but then you may do serious damage to your engine and have to overhaul it. So to some extent, we're sort of experimenting as we go with this situation.
Richard Wunderman, do you foresee any changes to policy regarding air travel and ash as a result of this eruption?
You know, pretty much any eruption that happens almost anywhere in the globe these days generates a lot of new science and a lot of new insights. There's so many people starting to work in this area. And there's, by the way, this is not my expertise, satellite remote sensing, but I read my colleagues' work and I talk with them at conferences and things. So I would say that, yeah, there's likely not just policy but science as well. And this thing, for example, with the airlines wanting to send sort of spotter scouting planes out to sort of prove that everything's okay is you know, a very interesting new approach to this. But what we really need is planes that are instrumented and carefully measuring, you know, moment to moment what the concentration of ash is, what, you know, is going on, where they are, and we can then correlate that with the satellite remote sensing. Without that correlation, you really don't learn very much. And, you know, did the plane even go through a concentrated or dilute or any, what part of the plume did they go through and this sort of thing?
So is it possible to use technology, Richard, to strengthen, you know, these airplane windshields or use advanced filters to prevent damage to the engines of the airplane after this kind of episode?
Well, you know, there's a lot of debate about all these things. I'm of the school that you could have one particle in a cubic kilometer of air and you'd probably be okay. There's others that, you know, as Alan just said, that sort of believe that you really don't have any, let's just stay completely away from it. And really therein lies the problem we're in, because the meteorologist, some human being, has to look at the satellite data and say, okay, there's obviously a dense plume here. The data only maybe has a resolution of half a kilometer. Where's the edge of that cloud? Mm. Well, any normal intelligent person would draw a little padding around the edge and say, well, you know, because of the vagaries of the science, I'm going to put a little bit of extra distance. And they draw an envelope that basically is the no-fly zone. And, you know, it's more complicated than that, but that's the simplistic kind of thing they have to do. And they have a very difficult job, and they do the best they can.
Right, with the information that they've got. I'm going to interrupt you because we have lots more calls to get in here before the end of this segment. Dave is on the line from Bloomingdale, New York. Dave, thanks for calling. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hello.
First, I'd like to just say, make a point that we've had tsunamis, we had Haiti, we had Katrina, and earthquakes in South America where hundreds of thousands of people were killed. And as far as I know, this, I guess it's an economic catastrophe, nobody has died from it. But I listen to a lot of talk radio, and my question to Richard and Alan is, how do they feel? Do they feel that the governments of Europe overreacted and shouldn't have shut down these airports so soon?
Dave, thank you. Alan Levin.
Well, I try not to have my own opinions on these things, but I can tell you that the opinions on that run the gamut. I mean, the airlines obviously do think that the government overreacted, or at least they're saying so. But, you know, given the safety issues in the past, reading some of these accident reports, talking to people who are intimately involved in the development of these engines, I think the governments did the prudent thing and followed what has been a worldwide policy for 20, 30 years that has prevented any accidents. So I think based on what I've seen, they followed the procedures that are in place and did so correctly.
In Europe, although I'm reading a piece here in the Financial Times, Alan, that says European officials in Brussels said that many of the flights that have been grounded by national aviation authorities in Europe would have gone ahead under U.S. aviation standards and urged that these standards be considered in the future. So is there a disparity?
Boy, I have not heard that. I'm not sure what standard they're talking about. I mean, this is a worldwide sort of a thing, and you know, it was a near catastrophe over Alaska in 1989 that was investigated by U.S. Officials that helped lead to some of these policies. So I'm not sure under what rules the U.S. authorities would have allowed these planes to fly.
Let's go to Marlborough, Massachusetts. Victoria is on the line. Hi, Victoria. Welcome to On Point.
What a wonderful thought-provoking program, but it's frustrating the sand out of me that we keep having examples of man-made and or mother nature-made crises and disasters and still miss the opportunity to brainstorm and realize that we do not have an infrastructure or the ability to handle ourselves, we, the global riders of this planet, to handle a disaster, be it New Orleans, Hades, concurrent disasters right now, Tibet and this horrible issue in the flying slowdown or stoppage. It seems if it affects the economy, it gets our attention, and then we talk about technology taking care of it. But what is it going to take for all the nations to realize that we do not have what it takes to manage?
We don't have the infrastructure in place. Well, it brings up a good point, Alan Levin. Are we going to be prepared for the next time that this might happen? Are we better prepared?
It's interesting. I spoke a day or so ago with a fellow who was around in the 1980s when these policies were being developed, and the one of the key problems with assessing a disaster like this is using hindsight to assess our performance. And he said that at the time, they never anticipated that a volcano would erupt in the fashion that this one did and send a plume over such a dense area of air travel, you know, and because normally what you have are volcanoes over the Pacific, over Alaska, and in fact, you know, we've had a number of eruptions in Iceland, and it's never the plume has never quite behaved this way. So they never anticipated that this would be as huge a problem as it is, and so as a result, they never put the resources into figuring out how to handle it. Now, moving forward, I can tell you, I think a lot of the engine manufacturers and the airlines see this as something they need to get a much better handle on so they can prevent this sort of thing from happening.
Richard Wunderman, from a scientific perspective, in our last 30 seconds here, how do we use hindsight to be better prepared next time?
Well, I think that there's, you know, speaking to Margaret's thing about crises, if you look at government funding for things like this, really, often it's a sawtooth. There's a crisis like this, and it generates a whole lot of funding, boatloads, and then the funding basically after some time, like 10 years, drops to zero. And this is not a really good way to run scientific programs, to be looking at these things constantly. They need stable funding. It doesn't have to be so great, but it just has to be consistent. That's a huge problem in the way government is run. It's very reactive to these things.
Richard Wunderman is a volcanologist with the Smithsonian Institution. Rick, thank you so much for being with us. And Alan Levin is an aviation and transportation correspondent for USA Today. Alan, thank you for your time.
Well, thanks. My pleasure.
We've been talking about fallout from the Iceland volcano, but some scientists are worried that a man-made disaster might be next. Loose nukes, or worse, a regional nuclear war. The dust and smoke from this scenario, they say, would cause a drastic drop in temperatures, plunging us into a dark, cold nuclear winter. Joining me now from Boulder, Colorado, is Dr. Brian Toon. He's chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Studies at the University of Colorado, where he conducts modeling, lab, and field studies in aerosol and cloud physics and climate chemistry. His article, South Asian Threat, Local Nuclear War Equals Global Suffering. It appeared in the January issue of Scientific American. Brian Toon, thanks for being with us. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
The volcano that we've been talking about from Iceland is producing one kind of cloud, a cloud of ash, and we're seeing its tremendous impact. You're writing about another kind of cloud, a cloud that would produce a nuclear winter. Could you describe what that might look like?
Certainly. So volcanoes, of course, have historically caused climate change, mostly by putting sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere. And the reason this matters to put things into the stratosphere is it doesn't rain there, so they will stay in the atmosphere for several years before they're removed, unlike the Icelandic ash, which should wash out within a few days of being erupted. So the first question is whether you put things into the stratosphere. Now, a nuclear weapon, even a small one like the one that fell on Hiroshima in the Second World War, creates a firestorm in the city, where it explodes by starting small fires all over the place, which merge and create a giant pyroconvective cloud, it's called, which is a big cumulus cloud full of smoke from the fire. So these have been observed several times. For example, in San Francisco after the Great Earthquake, there was a firestorm. There was one in Hiroshima. There were several in the Second World War in Dresden and Hamburg, for example. And what happens here is instead of a volcano erupting, the giant fire pushes soot into the stratosphere, or ashes from the fires.
That causes global cooling, obviously less sunlight, less precipitation. Are those the factors that come into play?
Exactly. So when a volcano erupts, it's not really the ash that causes climate change. It's the sulfate particles, which are transparent. They look like water, although they're sulfuric acid usually. But ash is very dark and black. So the volcanic particles just scatter sunlight around, which isn't very effective at keeping it from getting to the surface. Mm-hmm. But the ash absorbs it in the stratosphere, or the soot absorbs it in the stratosphere. So that is very effective at keeping sunlight from reaching the surface. And it also makes the stratosphere hot. And so you get two things happening. You get cooling at the ground and decrease of precipitation, and in the stratosphere you get destruction of the ozone layer, neither of which is particularly good.
Obviously, nobody wants to think about such a scenario, but how do you model a nuclear winter? I mean, what real-life factors do you draw on in your modeling?
Right. So we've modeled two scenarios. One is a full-scale conflict between Russia and the United States, but perhaps a more interesting one in the current day is a conflict between India and Pakistan. So the issues that you have to look at are how many weapons are used, and we assume that India and Pakistan would use less than their full arsenal, about 100 weapons. So people are often surprised to learn that India and Pakistan between them have well over 100 nuclear weapons, as far as we know. They're probably Hiroshima-sized weapons. And so we can go look at Hiroshima and see what the area that caught on fire was. And then we can use estimates of the amount of fuel that's in these cities to burn. So we targeted particular areas in India and Pakistan, which we thought might be attacked by the two countries if they had a war.
Mm-hmm.
And we used the amount of fuel we thought might be there. And then we used observations from forest fires to say this would go into the upper atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And then we used the same models that we used to understand how volcanoes affect the climate to predict what would happen to the smoke after it had been injected into the upper atmosphere.
And that's the connection for us here today. What would be the projected impact globally in our last 30 seconds here on agriculture, on health, on quality of life?
We are very surprised to discover that even a small war between India and Pakistan would probably be devastating to agriculture at mid-latitudes and even in the tropics because rainfall would be suppressed. And this would likely jeopardize a billion people on the planet who are now not able to afford all the food that they need or barely able to afford the food they need now. So it would cause a significant drop in agricultural productivity and starve those people to death. In addition, the ozone layer would be destroyed, and people at mid-latitudes probably would only be able to go outside for short periods of time, maybe 10 minutes, before they start to get a sunburn. So it would have effects. The starvation would obviously be the effect that would damage the most people.
Well, from one kind of cloud starting this hour to another, much more cataclysmic. We appreciate your information and your very interesting article. Brian Toon, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Brian Toon is the chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Studies at the University of Colorado. His article is South Asian Threat, Local Nuclear War Equals Global Suffering, from the Scientific American. You can continue the conversation, get our On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.